Taking a look now at patents, trademarks, copyrights, and licensing agreements. If you've got a great idea, maybe it should be patented or trademarked or copyrighted. We'll talk about all that in licensing agreements as well with our next guest. Jill Gilbert Welitok is a registered patent attorney, a CPA, and the managing attorney of Absolute Technology Law in Milwaukee. She currently represents over 200 patent and trademark clients and is the co-author of the Independent Inventors Handbook. It's published by Workman, and I've been enjoying reading it, I can tell you that. It's pretty straightforward. The writing is great, and I can understand it. I think anybody can understand it. And lots of great examples in the book as well of things that worked out well and some things that didn't work out so well. And so if you've got some questions about patenting or maybe a trademark or a copyright, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. And Jill Gilbert Welitok, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's really really great to have you with us. Your own family, I noted in the beginning, and your forward to the book. Your dad had an invention. I think he probably wished he'd have patented it.
Yes, my dad was the inventor of the wiggling fish on a plaque. So we all thought he was crazy doing the prototype of this little plastic fish, trying to make it move realistically. And he actually spent quite a bit of time, achieving that effect. And it was very startling when you'd walk by and this fish would start moving, and you'd never seen anything like that before.
Well, I have to tell you, I received something very similar. It was a fish that wiggled like that, but it also sang a song of some sort.
Oh, well, that's one of the subsequent generations. My dad actually invented that wiggling fish about 30 years ago, and he was advised not to patent it, that it was probably not a marketable idea. But I guess that just goes to show that no one knows what people buy and how markets are created.
Oh, that's for sure. Well, that may have spurred your interest in this whole area. But talk a bit about the Independent Inventors Handbook and let us know, our listeners know, about what's in it and how they can profit from it.
Well, the Independent Inventors Handbook was a book that I wrote in collaboration with Lewis Foreman, an entrepreneur, and it is written with a view toward someone who wants to start up a business or launch a product but doesn't have a lot of capital to lose, or for small companies that want to expand their existing product line and they want to do this in an efficient manner and they want to secure patent protection efficiently.
And you have many great examples in the book, which is something that helps make the book come to life for me.
So we have examples of some very famous inventors that you're familiar with. For example, what's the guy's name who invented the television set? A farm boy?
Yeah.
Who happened to catch signals dancing off of his farm implements and invented, what we now know to be the television set. Earl Tupper with his Tupperware, something that is as mundane as a food container, became one of the best-selling products in U.S. history. So all of these people were inventors that had ideas that were mainstream and seemed ordinary, but they required experimentation and protection for the execution and growth of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was last Sunday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel had a front-page story that said something like patent backlog clogs recovery, showing that it takes about 5 years to issue a patent because of a huge backlog at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And that's got to be concerning for the person who's applying for a patent these days.
Well, yeah, you know what, though? That is misleading. They talk about a five-year backlog. But that you have to look at who is writing those patents, for one thing. Very large companies are often writing those patents that are concerned about preempting entire fields of technology and securing as broad a patent protection as possible. So they'll keep those patents pending for a while because they want to preempt those fields. You also have a lot of inventors writing patent applications that do not know the rules. Are using software, using do-it-yourself types of services. And so the examiners have to work with them, repeatedly issuing office actions, repeatedly issuing office actions so that they, can get the claims in a shape or form that they can allow. So all of that takes time, and it contributes to that disallowance rate that I think the authors of the article were very concerned about. I think they researched it and determined that 7 out of 10 patents are disallowed. But more than half of those might be for people that are seeking much broader protection than is warranted, or by people that aren't professionals and are interfacing with the patent system.
For something to be patented, I think I'm trying to remember the exact words. It needs to be novel, non-obvious, and useful. Are those
correct? And non-obvious is the one that usually gives people the most trouble. And this is what concerns me about kind of those do-it-yourself services and invent help, or even patent attorneys that are trained as engineers and don't have an eye toward the client's market. You have to understand what is novel about the invention in terms of what if it's bringing to the marketplace. The wiggling fish is something that moves mechanically on and is mounted to a board. Well, in some sense, that's not obvious, but in another sense, it creates a visual effect that is very novel and kind of enthralled people for generations and created a worldwide market. So an attorney that is not just skilled in engineering but also understands the market in which you operate would be able to point out that type of novelty, those market aspects, those things you want to foreclose the competition from doing in a very simple manner to a patent examiner and hopefully get your patent issued in about 2 years and not 5 with a minimum of office action.
We have a number of people who want to visit with you, so I want to go to the phones here. Gail in Watertown, we'll turn to you first. Gail, hello.
Hi there. I would like some advice. I have an idea for a decorative book. This would be for something people often use in homes, and they always have ugly books for this and don't use it often. So the book would be more of a decoration than a book. Kind of like a coffee table book, but I'm afraid, where would I take it? And I'm afraid to show it to anyone to publish it because I'm afraid they would just steal the idea.
Well, first of all, you have a book that you've written, and copyright protection attaches to a work of authorship automatically upon creation.
It's more
authorship or art. So copyright protection is free and automatic and immediately attaches to the work that you're doing and prevents other people from copying it.
Okay.
Now, the public disclosure rule applies to inventions. It implies to novel technology, but your work, your book of artistic renderings is not an invention. It's not a new technology, and it's okay to disclose that in the public domain. You can register your copyright. You can go to the U.S. Copyright Office site, and they have an electronic form, and they'll take you through those instructions. It's about $35, and I'm going to give you that website. I'll look that up on Google right now.
And while she's doing that, we'll remind you, if you want to join in, call us at 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, and we'd be happy to hear from you. And, Jill, have you got that? Just about got it. I tell you what, she'll work on that, Gail, and I, in the meantime, will thank you very much for calling.
I'm sorry. You're asking me for that website, that
yes.
URL?
Yeah.
Okay, U.S. Copyright Office is www.copyright.gov.
Oh, so pretty simple.
Yeah, and they'll take you through that. You register that. Now, registering is not necessary for copyright protection. It is free and automatic. But it is generally something that you're going to want to do before you sue someone, bring a cause of action against them, and it can be done at any time.
All right. Thanks, Gail. Bill in Sun Prairie. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have an idea for a new concept for a wind machine. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how specific I have to be with design of it in order to successfully protect the idea. It's both a concept and, of course, it'll be a mechanism. So do I have to actually design the mechanism or just submit the concept?
Well, you do not have to have a working prototype, but your concept should be sufficiently developed so that you can file a patent application to enable one who is ordinarily skilled in the art to be able to make one of these. So presumably, if you had unlimited funds and time, you could make one of these.
Sure. All right. And with that, well, Joe may have some other comments on that, but we are going to take a quick break for a look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us on the Ideas Net. And then we'll be back with our guest, Jill Gilbert Wellytalk, as we talk patents, trademarks, copyrights, and licensing agreements here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening in here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here as we talk patents, trademarks, copyrights, and licensing agreements with Jill Gilbert Wellytalk, who is co-author of the book, The Independent Inventor's Handbook. She is a registered patent attorney, a CPA, and managing attorney of Absolute Technology Law in Milwaukee. So happy to have her along, and certainly look forward to hearing what you have to say, what questions you have for her. The caller who had a question about the specificity of a design before applying for a patent. Do you have to have the product developed, or how much information do you have to provide in the way of a plan or a blueprint?
Well, Larry, you don't have to have a working prototype, and very often patents are used to provide protection so that inventors can seek information about how to develop and produce their inventions. You very often don't know how you're going to make something until you talk to engineers, design professionals, and other experts. But you have a concept and you have a sense that it a working embodiment can be made in a number of ways. And that very often is the point in time which people seek patent protection. And then it also helps them deal with the time frame for getting an application to be examined and ultimately issued. It should dovetail with that development process.
All right, let's go to Judy in Two Harbors, Minnesota next. Judy, hello.
Hello. This is a wonderful topic. Thank you. I've written some original computer code for my website, and people who visit the site can just copy the source if they want to. And I'm just wondering how I can protect that code.
Well, Judy, that's a very interesting question. What you have is what's often referred to as open source software, where you allow other people to use your code without copyright restrictions. You can have a basic click agreement or some other type of agreement in force where people exercise use of your code subject to restrictions you place on the use of the code as a copyright holder. For example, you might require them to give you credit for use of the code and for modifications they make to it. Now, there is another direction that sometimes code developers go in, which is diametrically opposed to the sort of open source approach that you are taking. Sometimes people will patent a software program. A software patent would prevent competitors from writing equivalent code to perform some sort of novel function or problem solving that they've developed. So there are a broad range of protections and rights associated with software code, and it's a fascinating and evolving field.
Sure.
Judy, what does your code do?
It does graphic manipulations that no one else has ever done before, or no one else that I know of has ever done before.
And do you have any terms of use or of?
Well, all I have is a copyright notice on each page.
Okay. Well, you might want to have some simple terms of use posted because you're obviously concerned about how others might use or this code, and you envision it being used in a certain way, and whether or not that is consistent with how each user that accesses that code actually does use it is an issue. So if you want to contact me offline, I can probably give you some simple suggestions.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Awesome. Thanks a lot for calling. Let's turn to Mike in Green Bay. Hello, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Jill. I import wine from France and Spain, and I've got a wine that's named Celeste, and I've since found out that there's another wine from a different company in Spain that's called Celeste. But on wine labels, of course, there's lots of other information. There's a design, and there's other information about the wine. So could that be a potential problem, and how similar or dissimilar can trademarks be? And then second question is, if I do develop a name for a wine, and I'm absolutely 100% sure that it is unique, do you have automatic trademark guarantee as the creator of this name? That's it.
Okay.
Well, there's quite a few questions to parse there. First one is how similar do trademarks have to be before use of one precludes the other? Trademarks are based on prior use. Registration helps document prior use and is a formality that can be tremendously helpful. But basically, the first person to use a mark in commerce, and that is a very specific requirement, use of the mark in commerce. If you are the first one to do that, you acquire use superior rights in the trademark. So I don't know who used the mark. Celeste was it first on the wine?
Yeah, but, and it's the other company used it first.
But certainly they may have acquired superior rights subject to any issues of abandonment, but that can be complicated. But you need to know that the first use generally determines superior rights.
Okay.
As to how similar the marks can be, well, you know, the marks cannot be confusingly similar. So if you were going to spell Celeste with an S and they spell it with a C, or you were going to change the script or have something that sounded phonetically similar, that might be confusingly similar to an ordinary consumer of your goods and services, and that too would be precluded.
Right. Well, what about, one's Spanish, one's French? I mean, there's other identifying information that is dissimilar, so...
Generally, foreign words, use of phonetic spellings, changes in appearance and script, if they have enough similarities, then a consumer would be confused. You're on shaky ground with that mark. Now, have you invested a lot in the labeling and promotion of the wine under this label?
No, not really. I mean, it's, enough, but, it costs thousands of dollars to change it, but that's all doable.
You know, another option is to achieve consent from the
right.
Primary trademark holder. They may not mind. You know, they might reach some agreement with you for some reasonable fee if you are not encroaching in their markets. And in some situations, they might even see it a plus. But then you're working to develop a brand over which you don't entirely have control and is not entirely owned by you.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Thanks very much.
Yep, thanks for calling. Tom in Fond du Lac, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thank you. I have a couple of patents, and I've had one which was denied. And in the marketing these patents, I talked to an individual at a company that was interested in one of them, and we discussed the other things I had and the one that was denied. And he asked who the examiners were, and I told him the names of the examiners, and he was familiar with these people, which I was quite amazed at. And he said the fellow who denied my patent, which I really thought had novelty, he said it's very seldom we get anything from him. I wonder if that's been your experience.
Well, I think patent examiners, it's a difficult job for them to ascertain novelty. So it's really the duty. And I'm sorry, your first name was?
Tom.
Tom,
thank you, Tom. So, Tom, it's really the duty of the inventor to draft an application and claims where the examiner is able to discern the scope of the invention and determine novelty. So that's the obligation of the person submitting the application. I don't know if you had the assistance of a professional in submitting your application.
Yes, I had patent attorneys.
You had patent attorneys.
Right.
And the examiner felt that it was not novel. Did the patent the patent attorneys that represented you, did they exercise their right to request a telephonic interview with the examiner so they could understand the examiner's thinking?
I don't know whether there was a conversation, actually, but there was a lot of correspondence back and forth and appeals, and, we went through the whole nine yards and to wind up with nothing.
Now, and that is sometimes the crux of the problem, that lot of correspondence. That really ties into what the Journal Sentinel, the concerns that they were raising last weekend. You have things pending for 5 years, and you have attorneys and examiners sending lots of correspondence back and forth. 1, 2, 3 office actions, sometimes requests for continuing examination appeals. But sometimes the attorney needs to exercise that option to request a telephonic interview with the examiner, or maybe even, show the invention to the examiner in the examiner's office, all of which are provided under the rules for patent examination. And you can expedite that process. You also have to make sure that you are complying with the rules of the patent office and very clearly conveying the points of novelty and the distinguishing features from other inventions. Patents can be difficult to write, and I'm seeing a lot of do-it-yourselfers that are not getting the job done, and sometimes attorneys that are very focused on engineering aspects or looking at things in a form-oriented way, not communicating with examiners and finding out what it is that the examiner is really concerned about in terms of what your invention reads on, which is another way of saying why your invention is so much like something else in the prior art that they can't grant it. So I can't speak to the specifics of your invention, but it sounds like there was a lot of written communication.
And a lot of expense.
Yeah, and written communication is very expensive. It's, in my experience, it's much less expensive for me to immediately pick up the phone to try to establish communication with an examiner and find out what the examiner's thinking rather than have, four responses later.
Yeah.
Could you resubmit and try to run it through again?
Well, resubmitting poses special problems. Generally, once there's been a public disclosure of an application, and your application was likely published if it was pending 18 months or more, it enters the public domain, whether or not a patent is allowed. So you may have issues with public disclosure. Okay, and now if you've changed or modified or progressed the invention, there may be new aspects of it that bring that invention closer to being marketable that may be worth seeking protection for.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I just got the impression that it's somewhat dependent upon which examiner you got, whether how likely you were to receive a patent.
No.
Well, I kind of have a unique view that the examiners are, I don't know how unique this view is, but I find the examiners to be actually pretty well-trained. They have subject matter expertise in their fields. They deal with a lot of difficult people every day, attorneys from large firms, attorneys from small firms, individual inventors, and very complex set of rules that the person that they're dealing with may not always be familiar with. But it is their job to examine applications and allow the ones that they should, and it is our job to communicate with them, to write clearly and convey the points of novelty. I generally find examiners to be approachable, with the exception of one once who did not want to speak with me and felt all communication should be in writing. But that's one experience of mine among hundreds. And sometimes the examiner is dead on. They find something that you didn't contemplate, and they're absolutely right that it was contemplated in the prior art. And maybe you or I or your patent attorney didn't find it because it was obscurely worded, so it was difficult to pick up in the search. It may never have been brought to market because it was impractical or unprofitable to bring it to market. And sometimes they do find references that are dead on. And by acknowledging that and preventing an inventor from going further, sometimes they do the right thing. But that said, your attorney should have a good read on whether or not an application has a good chance of being allowed before they file that application and begin taking you down that process.
All right. Thank you, Tom, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Lee in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Lee.
Hi there. I'm an evening and weekend kind of a job. I tend to do a little bit of invention research and design. I'm familiar with doing patent work in other parts of the world, but I wanted your advice, and I'll take my answer off the air. Is it best to get a design patented before you go trying to work it through with a manufacturer in the U.S., or does it not matter?
Well, we're just going to speak to U.S. law, you know, this being a you know, radio show in the U.S., but generally, you know, there are two ways you can operate if you do not want to disclose your invention immediately. Once you disclose your invention to someone who is not an inventor, other than some exceptions for experimental use, but generally once you disclose that invention, it starts a one-year clock ticking where you have to file for patent protection or your invention will enter the public domain. So there are two solutions to the issue of that clock ticking. One is to have a non-disclosure agreement where you disclose it to someone in secrecy so that it does not operate as a disclosure for patent law purposes, but those are difficult to enforce. Another way is to file for patent protection immediately to keep that disclosure from being a bar on your patent protection. And there's a process called a provisional patent application or type of application subject to a simplified process, provisional application that allows you to file a simplified version of your patent application, get the patent pending status, and not have to worry quite so much about whether or not you're making a public disclosure as you're trying to gain information that will help you see if it's going to be profitable to get your product off the ground.
Hmm. Thanks for calling. Paul in Clintonville. On to you now. Hi, Paul.
Well, good morning. I was just kind of curious. Well, first of all, I guess I'm a little fledgling watercolor artist in my retirement with not a whole lot to do, and it's kind of fun to play with. Anyway, I post a lot of my stuff on Facebook for the fun of it, for, you know, a few selected friends and that type of thing. I suppose realizing it can go anywhere. You're right. I, of course, sign or put a little some initials on my stuff.
Oh, we're losing you.
Oh, I'm sorry. There's nothing really to prevent anybody from grabbing the thing offline. My question would be recourse, since this thing could go anywhere in the world, U.S. or overseas, can anything be done? And how do you go about doing that sort of thing to get recourse?
So your question, I believe, is if someone violates your copyright by using something that you have on the Internet, how would you pursue them?
You haven't.
And the answer is that it's like bringing any other litigation. It's going to be costly, cumbersome, impractical for things that are not of substantial value.
So for my $20 painting, I pay, you know, $100,000 to try to pursue somebody or whatever.
Right.
Right. So, when you're posting things on Facebook, you that said, if you see somebody using your copyrighted material, the penalties for willful infringement of your copyright are very substantial, and you will find attorneys that are willing to write them a cease and desist letter and perhaps file an action on your behalf if someone is willfully infringing. But I guess, you know, from a business standpoint, you have to determine whether, it's a benefit to have exposure for your work versus keeping it in a more secured place than the Internet where it can be copied or appropriated. And I think that goes back to what the first caller was asking about, you know, should she get out and market this photo book and show it to people with the risk that someone may copy the ideas or appropriate them. You know, it's always a balancing act.
The higher the value, the more likely the protection, so to speak.
Right. The higher the value, the
item being dealt with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But you know, there's a benefit to exposure for your work.
Yeah.
You know, so you're always going to expose your work to the possibility of wrongful appropriation when you're trying to market it and you know, get the public to become aware of it. So you always have to balance those two things.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul. Barbara in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Like most everybody else, I have an idea. My question is, do you know of the existence of nonprofits or other inspired organizations that would vet an idea to enhance local economy?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure I understand the question. Nonprofits that would...
Like vet or, for instance, my idea concerns a stand for tubes of paint for artists. Usually they have them in drawers, helter-skelter. It's a niche market. I have a strong belief that it does exist, even if it didn't, let's pretend it did. Let's say that the local economy was interested in sponsoring entrepreneurs or at least mentoring, perhaps, such ideas.
Well, I think
the
mentoring aspect we can help you with. There are, as far as I know, 50 inventors and entrepreneurs clubs all over the state of Wisconsin, and they were initially funded by a seed grant from the Department of Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, let's see, I know we have an inventors club in Milwaukee that we host. You can find out about that by going to www.milwaukeepatents.com. Mm-hmm. You can find out about inventors and entrepreneurs clubs throughout the state by going to www.wenportal.com.
Okay, WEN as in W-I-N?
W-E-N, Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Network.
Okay.
Portal, P-O-R-T-A-L.com. And I believe there is a link to the right side of their homepage, which will identify inventors and entrepreneurs clubs all over the state of Wisconsin. And to my knowledge, those are open to the public without any... membership fee or obligation, but they are basically mentoring forums for inventors and their ideas and for people looking for inventors with ideas that they might possibly want to develop to enhance their own mm-hmm. businesses and competitive positions.
I know we were informed about a local inventors group in Appleton called Inventors Network of Wisconsin. And I know they're meeting September 14th at the Bordini Center in Appleton at 6:30 in the evening. So there are, as you say, Jill, there are groups all over the state now that can help people with their inventions. And certainly it's worthwhile, I think, to get involved.
Yeah, and, you know, our Inventors Club will be meeting in Milwaukee September 17th in the Germania Building downtown at 135 West Wells.
At what time was that?
It will be at 5:45,
mm-hmm.
and it's on that Milwaukee Patents website.
Okay, and again, that was the Milwaukee Patents.
Yeah, milwaukeepatents.com, and click on the Inventors Forum. So those can be extraordinarily helpful. I know a lot of people that have found the manufacturing, marketing, funding resources they need to, you know, discover that missing piece of the puzzle. Sometimes they need assistance with patent or trademark issues. But you know, we originally started the club because I found that inventors need so many services and resources that are just, you know, beyond the scope of what we provide, and we don't want people to be filing patent applications unless they can commercialize products and profit from those patents.
Well, I tell you what, we are out of time, Jill, but I want to thank you very much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Perhaps we could do this again sometime.
Thank you.
Jill is Jill Gilbert Wellitok is one of the co-authors, along with Lewis Foreman, of the book called The Independent Inventor's Handbook, The Independent Inventor's Handbook. Pleased to have her with us. We'll try and get her back again. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.